Exactly. So we talked a little bit about linear accelerators last time. I'm going to go back to the book. This little couple of pages that I just wrote down before class are from, I think, actually the very first chapter of the book, but they fit in kind of nicely here and what I'm going to connect them to, because it is a little bit of a magic trick that I'll show you. And then if we have time, we'll start synchrotron radiation, or maybe we'll get to it next time. Another quick comment, I am going to send out, I just got a query from Forrest earlier via email about the nature and length and kind of style of the final presentations. I'm going to send out some guidelines and send out a sample presentation from a previous course for you guys to have a little bit of guidance on, so you're not being thrown, you know, kind of into the deep end on that. When you get to graduate school, a lot of graduate schools, this one used to have it, I think it still does, I'm not sure. Stony Brook certainly still has it. Actually have a required presentation course in graduate class, in graduate school. We do too, yeah. So where you have to read a paper or a couple of papers and actually give a presentation on those papers to the rest of the class. So get used to it. It is part of your scientific education. Is presenting your work in front of others, some of whom may be more critical than others as well. But we are all friends here. So I'll start with momentum compaction. We've got, you know, plenty of time to cover what we need to cover today. I think the rest of the course is kind of elastic. So momentum compaction is a funny thing, and you know, how do you compact momentum? Does that mean you reduce the momentum spread? No, it's a different thing related to circular accelerators. Last time we talked all about linear accelerators. This is kind of a prerequisite for understanding what longitudinal motion looks like in circular accelerators. So we're going to start off again, but not without any of Suba's fancy RF cavities or anything like that, just motion, circular motion in a magnetic field. So that means you're going around in some kind of circular or closed path. It doesn't have to be circular. It could be a racetrack. It could be some figure eight even. But at the end of the day, you know, if it is this closed single loop, as you go around this path, you're going to cover the circumference. So the integral, path integral at once around of that path length is 2 pi rho, right? Just circumference is 2 pi r. So, but you know that you're not really filling this entire ring with dipoles. Sometimes there are bending magnets. Sometimes there are straights and quadrupole magnets. So the bend radius does not have to be constant throughout the entire accelerator. And in fact, for a lot of the bigger accelerators, what you do is move that rho underneath. You can say it can vary with the s-coordinate, vary with your location around the ring. That means you have some dipoles that are a fixed length, and then other areas where the beam goes kind of straight. And instead of a big circle, this thing, I mean, it even gets to the point where at RIC, the accelerator kind of looks like a curvy hexagon. There are bends, you know, there are six areas where the beam actually bends quite a lot. This is a bad picture, at least, and there are six areas where the beam goes pretty straight as well. So you can think of these areas as being kind of the bendy areas. Something like that. You know, you get the picture. Any event, non-circular, right, is the key thing here. But you still have this equation, and this equation still holds, even if that rho is not constant, but varies. So we had our good old cyclotron equation. This P over Q is equal to B rho, and that's the bending field, the bending dipole field. And now, you know, I've just said, gosh, this rho and therefore this B, I know if there's no RF, no electric fields, this momentum isn't changing. The charge of the particles isn't changing. But, you know, that means that these things kind of have to trade off. And wherever there's magnetic field, there has to be some sort of bend radius. And if there's almost, you know, if there's effectively no magnetic field, it's effectively like the bend radius goes to infinity, which means the particles are moving close to in a straight line. And I still can get a product there that is, you know, non-zero. So those are the two sections of these accelerators. Move these around in a similar sort of way. Move that row over, and you can, what you can do is you can end up getting a P. Oh, substitute this row into that equation. So you get an equation here that the momentum is now related to something like the integral of the magnetic field around the machine, right, times the charge divided by 2 pi. Okay? So here's the simple case in the lower left-hand picture here. Here's a circular accelerator with just a constant magnetic field all around, so particles are moving in circles. Higher momentum particles, you know, have a larger radius, right? Higher momentum, larger radius for the same field. So that larger momentum, P plus delta P, has a larger radius. P minus delta P has a smaller radius. That's a different path length, man, right? That's a different circumference as well. We were just talking about circumferences. So the smaller momentum means smaller circumference. The larger momentum means larger circumference. That is, you know, I'll write down part of the answer right now as part of the warning. This is a classical way of looking at things, right? So, good morning.
Good morning.
Or good afternoon, whatever day it is. So, so I've got particles moving around in these circles in this field, and a larger momentum means a larger path length. Is kind of this classical feeling, right? To have a larger momentum, I move out, and have a smaller momentum, I move in. I have a smaller bend radius. So, how can I quantify this? How can I talk about this with my accelerator buddies? I just can't say, you know. I want to talk about the difference in path length for a difference in momentum. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about, let's say L is that circumference, that total integral of path length around the machine. And I'm going to talk about the fractional change in circumference, dl over L, nice unitless quantity, divided by a fractional change in momentum, another nice unitless quantity. So very clearly this thing is the ratio of two unitless things, so it's unitless. So I can say, gosh, one is one big. Yeah, probably one is really big, actually. It means the circumference doubles if I double the radius or something like that. Naively, it feels like, you know, it's about one for this system here. And if I move the L's and the P's over, I've got a nice little differential relation, right? How the path length changes with momentum. So for the system, as a matter of fact, right, let's say the, you know, well, L is 2 pi rho, of course, and 2 pi rho happens to be 2 pi times P over QB, right? So that means that DL DP is equal to what? DL dP is equal to 2 pi over QB. Well, what's L over P? L over P is also, whoops, oh no, I'm off the bottom there. L over P is also 2 pi over QB. Right? If you just look at this relationship here, because they're linearly related. And if you put both of those things together and stick them in there, that implies that momentum of compaction of a constant magnetic field with particles moving in circles is in fact one, right? So for constant magnetic field. And it feels kind of boring. It feels like, why did I bother defining this thing? So for folks that are coming back, just remember that momentum compaction is how the circumference of a particle moving around a circular accelerator now changes with a change in its momentum. Okay? So if I fractionally change the momentum by 20% in a constant field like this, I fractionally change the radius by 20%. No surprise, since they are linearly related. Okay? And all of this is only because of the magic of this equation where B and rho are constant. If B and rho are not constant and differ with different S's, I can actually break this thing. This differential relation becomes different now. So let's look at one example that's a fun example. It's not accelerators, but much more accessible. And that's the momentum compaction of gravity, which is the thing I started sketching out just before class. So here I've got the Earth and my really bad doodle of the Earth and a satellite circling the Earth in the circular orbit. Okay, so we have classical gravity, first year physics gravity, right, inverse square law. And the force of gravity better be the centripetal force, better be mv squared over r, right? Centripetal acceleration is v squared over r, so this thing is mv squared over r. And since p classically is mv, I just wrote it down in terms of p because, of course, all of our momentum compaction stuff is in terms of momentas and not velocities because we are relativistic physicists. So start playing with this, right? Now I've got this nice little equation with those two forces, you know, equivalent. Write them out. Write out a dr dp. It's kind of like, you know, except for the two pi's, it's like dl dp, right? And since I'm taking everything fractionally, all the two pi's end up canceling anyway. So I can figure out, you know, from this, I've got radius, which is like rho. I've got momentum in here. And I've got the circumference, like 2 pi r. So I can figure out what this momentum compaction is for gravity. And if I work it all out, you know, crazily enough, yes, it's a unitless thing. And then, in fact, is the opposite sign is classical magnetism. So if I've got the opposite sign is something moving in a constant magnetic field. I drew a little picture here because this minus 2, among other things, is why Saturn's rings have gaps, right? There's something called a negative mass instability that comes from this sort of thing. And I'll draw a little picture of Saturn or something like that to help remind the casual reader or listener at home that this is somehow related to Saturn's rings. But the other kind of counterintuitive thing is just even doing something like piloting the space shuttle or a spaceship, right, the satellite in orbit. Now, naively, you think, okay, if I'm in orbit and I turn on my thrusters and I accelerate, I change my momentum in the forward direction, so I have, you know, something firing out the back, I should kind of go higher, right? It feels natural. I should go in a larger orbit. No, wrong. That's why it's negative mass. Turns out that because of this, if I gain momentum, I lose radius or path length. So I end up, if I increase my momentum, I move down. And if I lower my momentum, I move up. I know, I get that face too when I think about it because it doesn't make my tummy happy, right? So if you fire your forward thrusters, so to go up in a spaceship, fire your forward thrusters if you're in orbit. If you're in orbit, and that's the key thing. And if you're not, you know, if you're not in orbit, who cares, right? Other crazy things happen. But if you want to go down, you fire your backwards thrusters. And in fact, you know, this is partly why you have to have such high velocities coming into the atmosphere when you're re-entering is because you do kind of this exact trick. You need to end up on with a velocity essentially near the Earth's surface that is close to escape velocity if you're coming back in. And then you shed some of that with aerobraking and resistance to the atmosphere. Well, yes.
Are you saying that you slow down as you approach your apogee, or are you saying that you have to slow down
to raise your apogee? So this is all circular orbits, man.
Okay.
Right? This little picture here was circular orbits. Right? Once you get into elliptical orbits, your momentum is, different depending on where you are in the orbit and stuff like that. There are transfer orbits. So if you are, I was a geek when I was young. I loved my NASA buddies. If you're in an elliptical orbit and you fire your thrusters, backwards at perigee, not apogee, right? You can move into, a circular orbit that's out here, right? Or if you fire your thrusters, at perigee, you can end up in the circular orbit. These are called transfer orbits, right? Where you end up moving into an elliptical orbit to get to a different altitude.
It's like a Hohmann transfer or something.
Well, Hohmann transfers are different, too. A Hohmann transfer, you also include the sun's gravity in the equation, and you do, a gravitational... Hohmann transfers are minimum time transfers, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
I just thought it was when you did a burn at perigee to raise your apogee.
Okay.
And you burnt at apogee. I don't know.
Fair enough. Yeah, I don't remember either. So, but in any event, I mean the God's honest truth is going back to the narrative of this curious thing. Is that for gravity with a momentum compaction of -2, effectively objects in orbit look like they have negative mass. You push from the back, you accelerate them, and they go down, or you decelerate them and they go up, right? So, and that is partly why, Saturn's rings have some of the orbital mechanics that they do. So this was also in that section in the book, by the way. This calculation was also done in chapter, 1.6, I think, section 1.6 of the book. So where does all of this stuff get you? Okay. Well, let's go back to last week's lecture. And it was last week's lecture. Okay, thank heavens. Let's go back to RF land, okay? And in RF land, we were looking at things like electric field or voltage versus time. And now what I've done is I'm going to build a circular accelerator. Before, I had these Linacs, and these Linacs had these RF cavities that were spaced out. And every time I got acceleration, every time I got electric field boost from one of these things, I would gain some momentum. And as I gain that momentum, I'd also, change my velocity to the point where I'm, okay, if I'm an electron, I'm pretty much hyper-relativistic, and at that point, I'm just moving the speed of light, right, ultra-relativistically. So this Linac is, either a low-energy electron or a typical proton or something like that. Proton Linux, you have to scale all of this stuff like the ESS I showed last class. So, but this is expensive stuff, right? These RF cavities, they require big power sources that are oscillating at hundreds of megahertz or gigahertz or something like that. So let me pull out the green one here, right? These things, RF stuff is costly, and costly stuff makes us unhappy. So for a circular accelerator to get up to very high energies, what you do is you only have one RF cavity here, and then you put magnets everywhere else. And you bend the particles around, just like the cyclotron I showed, kind of the first day of class. And what you do is you set things up so that every time you hit this RF, you get an electric field kick. So every time you go through that RF, you gain some energy. Magnets are expensive too, but not as expensive as RF. The magnets, you can change the field in the magnets with, really, you know, they're with big power supplies, but they're not megahertz or gigahertz power supplies. They're big kind of slow DC power supplies that people know how to build. You know, you can build nowadays, I mean, crazily enough, though, you talk about magnets being expensive. At the LHC, you have superconducting magnets that have typical currents around, 7,000-8,000 amps, something like that. For the electron-ion collider that we're talking about designing and building at Jefferson Lab, there's one variation that actually has power supply currents in our magnets that are about 13 or 14,000 amps. Don't stick your tongue on it. Right? That's, you know, amps kill. Volts don't kill. It's the amps that kill you. And that's a lot of amps. So, but yes, magnets are expensive, but when you get right down to it, so is digging a big tunnel that's expensive. Accelerators are expensive, right? I mean, at the end of the day, frankly. And if you're digging a big tunnel, then, you know, there's a... So you gain energy in the RF, which means you gain, you know, so you're gaining momentum as well, okay? But remember, P over Q is equal to B rho. Well, now rho is constant, right? I've built this thing as one big circle with a fairly small beam tube. So that means that a momentum that's changing with time implies that the magnets have to change with time. So I have to synchronize the energy gain and the magnets and the magnetic field. And what did people call this thing when they built it, the first one? Because you have to synchronize those things. That's what's called a synchrotron. And fundamentally, at the end of the day, a synchrotron is called that because what you're doing is you're doing a little miracle. You're using your expensive RF over and over and over again. I can run my particles, you know, through that, and every time they go through, they gain some energy. As long as I synchronize the path around so that the particles always hit the RF in the same phase, you know, so now this is, you know, many, 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 you know, cycles of this RF later, I end up hitting it again at another nice phase, I can end up riding this thing around, right? So I can use the RF many, many times, much more efficiently than the SLINAC. But at the same time, there's this extra cost of having to do the synchronization and the magnets. And there's another problem that I'll show you that crops up. Remember, with electron machines, right, I tended to ride the crest of this thing because the electrons are all moving close to the speed of light. They don't really, the momentum spread among them does not really mean there's much of a velocity spread, so they don't tend to spread out longitudinally. Protons, however, really do, and most other, you know, any other heavier particle does. So the heavier particles, remember, I have to give the higher energy particles that arrived earlier a little less energy. So, you know, instead for protons or something like that, I want to ride, you know, somewhere on this rising edge. Because that means the faster particles get less energy, the design particles right here, get about the energy that I want, and the particles that are too slow and lead behind in time end up getting more energy and catching up. So things are synchronized. That is a lie. Okay? And it's the truth. It's the truth. Okay, it's the truth for one part of the system. Remember, I blathered on and on about this constant field stuff, and I emphasized that this was a classical picture. This is a classical way of looking at things. Okay? So classically, right, I'm going to want my protons on the rising edge, on the rising V of T, to keep them bunched. In the relativistic sense, let's think about this hyper-relativistically, and let me go back to this picture and talk about this picture hyper-relativistically now, okay? There's hyper-relativistically all of the particles, and remember, this is time that we're talking about here. In the classical sense, right, a particle that was moving on this larger orbit also had a larger momentum, but it ended up in something like the cyclotron in the classical cyclotron, the increase in velocity exactly corresponded to the increase in path length. So everybody kind of stayed together. In the relativistic sense, everybody's moving the speed of light. Increased momentum does not increase your velocity much at all. So increased momentum is an increase in path length, so the faster particles actually lag behind in time. The higher momentum particles lag behind in time because they have to go around a further distance, but they're all at the same, they're all at light speed, right? So let's write that, you know, that down, because that feels a little bit counterintuitive. So relativistically, okay, I've got the same picture as I did before. So I'll draw the same picture as I did before. Okay. And I've got, you know, my regular momentum. And yes, in fact, my higher momentum particles still have a larger radius, because I can't violate that P over Q equals B rho thing. Smaller momentum particles have a smaller radius. Okay. But what's really happening? Well, the P plus delta P has a longer path. And the P minus delta P has a shorter path. And what I end up with is that, but all of them have the velocity about c. So that means that the p plus delta p, the longer path but the same velocity, means lag in, you know, means I lag in time of revolution. And the P minus delta P means I lead in time of revolution. To focus, I still want the same things. I still want this guy, the P plus delta P, to get closer to P. Right? So, but now he's lagging in time. So that means instead of being on the leading edge, on the rising edge of the VOT, what I need to do is I need to put everybody on the other side of that curve. I need to put everybody, I'm using crazy colors all over the place, it must be Christmas. So this is time and this is my voltage curve. Okay. And where do I want to put everybody now? I want to put everybody here. Because anybody lagging in time gets less voltage. And anybody leading in time gets more voltage, which is the thing I need to do to focus the system longitudinally. To move things, yeah, to move the particles. Oh! It worked both ways, yes, exactly. So this is on the falling edge now. So relativistic. Okay. What I want to do is I want to put these things on the falling edge to keep focused, to keep bunched, it's called.
This is only for very relativistic particles, right?
So, interestingly, you should say that, okay? What does very relativistic mean, right?
I'm assuming there's a place where they, like, transition from one to the other.
That is exactly the word you have been reading, young man. So there is, okay, so there is a situation classically where the higher momentum particles win the race. There's a situation relativistically, hyper-relativistically, where the higher momentum particles lose the race. That means there must be a time somewhere in between where there's a tie. And where regardless of your momentum, you always get back at the same time. Right? Because in one case they win, in one case they lose. There must be a zero somewhere, right? So there is a magic for a given set of magnets, a given configuration of these different path lengths for different momenta, there is a situation, okay? So you know, we've just argued, you know, there must be a time, or there must be an energy or a gamma, right, since we're talking relativistically here, where all particles have the same revolution frequency. For different momentas. Okay, and since, you know, since we're relativistic theory, you know, physicists, let's talk about that gamma for a second. Accelerator physicists call this magic thing gamma T. What does that T stand for? Transition. It's called transition energy. Or gamma. But, you know, gamma mc squared is the energy, so we just, you know, use gamma for call gamma energy. So this thing, okay, and this is a nice dimensionless number, right? It goes from 1 to infinity, and it tells you how relativistic a particle is, right? You know, gamma much, much greater than 1, of course, is hyper-relativistic for, you know, typically a typical medium gamma T is about something like, gosh, let's see. So gold goes through transition in RIC, but protons do not. So a typical number here at RIC is something like 18. And don't quote me on that number, but it's certainly in that neighborhood. Okay. So, you know, that's actually kind of an interesting number. It's not huge, but it's not small. On the other hand, gamma equals 18 particles. If you plug it in and calculate beta, beta is 0.999 something. I think it's 0.995 or something. It's not really, really close to one, but it's pretty close. And this is, you know, for Rick, where the injection energies, at least for protons, go from something like 23 GeV to 250 GeV. Or for gold, fully stripped gold, it goes from about 11 GeV up to 100 GeV. Now you can see that for gold, okay, you know, assuming that these things are in fact, you know, nucleons, and you can figure out the number of nucleons. This is GeV per nucleon, actually. You can see that, my gosh, we do, in fact, have to cross this gamma. This is clearly below that gamma for gold at injection and above that gamma for gold at the highest energy where we collide things. So there are accelerators that do a magic trick, and it is a serious magic trick. And that is, oh my gosh, I have to get from that side over there where particles are focused longitudinally. If I have them on the wrong side over here, focusing becomes defocusing. It pushes particles apart. So exactly at that energy as I'm accelerating these things, one trick I have to do is I actually have to take the phase of these RF cavities and jump it 180 degrees. And that's a cool trick. Imagine ringing a bell and listening to the bell vibrate and then saying, okay, quick, change the phase of that bell 180 degrees as fast as you can. There's a lot of energy sloshing around in that thing, and you got to pull it out and put it in backwards now, right? Within, you know, some reasonable number of cycles. Yeah, fun stuff, fun technology. So transition energy, I wanted to talk about momentum compaction because it feeds into the story about circular acceleration accelerators, and particularly this thing called transition energy and how you think and talk about transition, because I always thought this cool little idea that relativistically and classically the system is very different is a nice concept, and it's easy to visualize and easy to get your head around. Or at least not horribly, horribly difficult to get your head around. And then there's an entire chapter in the book. We won't go into it because we don't do synchrotrons, but you still have this picture now of time and voltage. Okay, and let's just talk about our hyper-relativistic hadron synchrotron up here, or our electron synchrotron, because electrons are always hyper, you know, kind of ultra-relativistic, right? So, you know, protons, electrons are kind of always above transition in a circular accelerator. And you're running at some level, you know, where you need a little bit of this slope. You need a little bit of this variation of voltage with arrival time to give you some of that longitudinal focusing. And you can start writing down differential equations, right? How does this voltage affect your momentum? And how does that change your path length? And you can write down eventually a set of equations that dominate longitudinal dynamics. What you'll find out is that this restoring force is sinusoidal, right? This, if you figure out, the restoring force just goes like the voltage, man, and the voltage is sinusoidal. So if the restoring force is sinusoidal in this system, what you'll end up finding out is that in whatever phase space you're working in, and quite often this phase space can be something like, it can be time, it can be RF phase, it can be longitudinal position, whatever that is, and this independent coordinate can be your offset in momentum, right, which is delta P over P, or it could be your delta E over E or some unit like that. But what do the dynamics look like? Well, if you're at zero, you always pick a reference particle that's zero, where zero goes to zero. It's hitting the RF system at exactly the right time every time. It's going around at exactly the same time every time. So that particle is perfect. But what happens for particles that are off of this? They go around, you know, they've got little restoring forces that make things look like simple harmonic oscillators. Because, by gosh, locally this restoring force looks linear. But if you work it all out, and go out to larger amplitudes, the restoring force isn't linear, it's sinusoidal. What you end up getting is a phase space picture that looks very much like this. What's that picture look like? It looks like a pendulum. And in fact, all of these dynamics, except for the completely different symbols of voltages and longitudinal position or arrival time or phase or whatever, if you normalize all of that stuff out and grab it and put it into constants, you end up finding out that the longitudinal dynamics of particles in a synchrotron look like pendulums. And that includes all of the wonderful stuff about the pendulum, including, when we get to it later on in the course, if we have time, nonlinear stuff, because pendulums are nonlinear.
Is that the same thing that you call us at electrics?
Who in here knows what a separatrix is? So who in here has ever taken a non... Okay. Uh-oh. Okay, now Suba's begged the question, so I have to indulge my... I have to wax prosaic here for a second, because I did my dissertation on nonlinear dynamics, so bear with me for a second here, okay? So this is a sneak preview, I suppose, of the nonlinear dynamics of the pendulum. So I've got a pendulum of length L and mass M, and it's going to, you know, for small oscillations, by gosh, you know, it looks like a simple harmonic oscillator. And for large oscillations, you know, once you get it to the point where, let's draw the pendulum phase space now. And the pendulum phase space is really nice because it's phi, and then it's something like, I don't know, it's something like phi dot. It's a momentum, right? So at 0, 0, right in the middle, my pendulum is completely at rest. It's not changing. It's at 0, phi. Everything is boring. Everything is fine, right? And if I move my pendulum and have it swing over, you know, small amplitudes, if I linearize the sine theta restoring force in the pendulum equation, I end up getting simple harmonic oscillator stuff. So what's really happening, though, once we start getting far away from that, is that you start seeing that these circles in this phase space stop being circles and start being these sorts of things. And what magic thing is happening out here? Well, this is zero, and this is plus pi, and this is minus pi. And what's happening on this particular thing, and yes, I will label it as a separatrix here, okay? That fixed point there in dynamicist terms, it's an SFP, right? A stable fixed point. a fixed point of a map or a fixed point of a dynamical system is a point that returns to itself every iteration of the system. And by gosh, 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay, boring, that's fine. But there also happens to be, way out here, if I take my pendulum and I balance it exactly perfectly on its tip, I have another fixed point. What's the U stand for? Come on. Unstable. There you go, okay? So, and there's kind of another one over there. As a matter of fact, in any dynamical system, if you study nonlinear dynamics in play, you'll find that these things actually come in pairs, and that what happens is as you change dynamics of the system, a stable fixed point appears with unstable fixed points around it, and there's a bifurcation and all sorts of fun stuff like that. So what's magic about the separatrix, okay? Well, the separatrix here, okay, is the contour or the trajectory, because in principle, okay, if a particle is exactly on that unstable fixed point and gets perturbed even in the slightest, it'll fall over and precess, and then it'll come back to the unstable fixed point and kind of hang out there for a very, very long time before it comes back, because the original perturbation of that unstable, perfectly balanced pendulum was an epsilon, right? It was a microscopic thing. So the separatrix's trajectory that separates stable, okay, and unstable, and I put quotes around here intentionally, motion. And by stable, what I mean is something that circulates around the original zero fixed point, right? And by unstable here, what I mean is that particles up here, if I give this thing too much theta dot, if I take my pendulum and I kick it too hard, it spins, it precesses, it goes through, you know, this system, and then it keeps on going forever. And that sure is unstable in the sense that it does not hang out around the original fixed point anymore. And the same goes in the bottom, right? A particle with a big negative kick can also precess the opposite direction. And those guys are unstable. Don't invite them over for drinks. So the separatrix is the magic trajectory. There is one, and it's unique, that separates those two out. That's one thing. It has a period that approaches infinity, right? Certainly the fixed points have no real period because the fixed points are, you know, fixed points. You always return to the same point. However, if you infinitesimally perturb this unstable fixed point, things will swing around on this trajectory and then hang out at this unstable fixed point a long, long, long time, and then maybe swing back and hang out there a long, long, long time. You can, if you make epsilon arbitrarily small, you can make this period arbitrarily large, and in fact it goes to infinity. Okay? So, you know, just like the physical pendulum system, all of that dynamics is here in the RF motion of synchrotron, you know, of particles in synchrotrons. So the separatrix does these magic things. It has this infinitely long period. And in fact, if I were to plot, you know, let's say I plot, you know, amplitude theta dot, and let's call this theta dot of the separatrix. And I'm plotting now the period of revolution of this pendulum, or the period of oscillation. Okay. Well, there's some base frequency or base period, square root of g over l, I think it is, or something like that, right? And as I get larger and larger amplitudes, this thing goes down. And in fact, if you really figure this out using pendulum dynamics and really calculate this functional dependence of this period with amplitude, it ends up being something horrible like the integral of an elliptical Bessel function or something. Elliptical function, not elliptical Bessel function. But it ends up being something horrible and painful. It's not trivial to do. You have to look it up and with Mathematica or Wolfram or something. But, you know, what happens is, at this magic separatrix, boom, yes, that goes there. And in fact, what happens here is that, you know, the unstable motion, you know, is like imaginary, you know, is like imaginary periods, right? Or imaginary frequencies. Effectively, what you're doing is you're just becoming completely unstable or unbounded. Now, one of the other, I'll pause here after a couple more comments, I suppose, because this is the interesting part. So this is just a boring old pendulum. And this is first-year pendulum stuff, right? However, something really interesting happens when you start perturbing the system. So you take your pendulum and you start adding a perturbation to it. Whatever the small perturbation is, usually you make it time dependent. So I add a time dependent drive. The first thing that happens, if you add even an epsilon level time dependent drive, the very first thing happens is that the separatrix... What happens to the separatrix? Believe it or not, you know, you'd think these things have been around forever. The separatrix goes chaotic. And that was not really well quantified and well known until... you know, 40 years ago, 30 years, you know, 40, 45, 50 years ago, not that long, considering that pendulum, you know, dynamics has been around since Newton. But it's because the period is infinite that any perturbation that drives that thing starts automatically making it crazy. And there are wonderful toys where you have like a pendulum hung on another pendulum, or some, you know, circular thing with a couple of pendulums hanging off it, and you flick it, and it's clearly chaotic. You can clearly tell it's not periodic. So this is, you know, really accessible stuff that yet all of the classical mechanics people did not really have the tools to understand, other than saying, boy, this is hard and I don't understand it, and there's a strong dependence on initial conditions, was the old way of putting it. But truly and fundamentally, if you like your nonlinear dynamics and you like chaos theory, there are good explanations for what happens here as these as that separatrix starts to break down. And as you turn this perturbation up, a lot of other horrible things can happen. Why is that relevant? Well, the systems driving this stuff in a real particle accelerator have noise in them, have frequencies in them, these higher order modes and other sorts of stuff that add into the system that create perturbations. So the dynamics is not as simple as just a boring old pendulum, even in the actual technological case of running a big particle accelerator. Part of my dissertation was doing nonlinear dynamics, not of this, but of transverse motion, not longitudinal motion, in the Fermilab Tevatron, almost exactly 37 years ago. God, I'm old. 27 years ago, I'm not that old. Thank you. So in any event, though, I wanted to get, you know, since Suba asked about the separatrix, I wanted to connect the separatrix stuff to chaos theory and to real nonlinear dynamics, because one of the first things you learn in nonlinear dynamics, just like in regular old boring dynamics and mechanics, everything is simple harmonic oscillators. In nonlinear dynamics, everything is pendulums. and you Fourier transform everything and pull out sinusoidal terms, and everything is pendulums. So if you want to become a budding nonlinear dynamicist, there's your start. Remember the lesson from Todd: everything is pendulums. So let me. I'll start. I got a couple minutes. Let's start talking about something that's, you know, from something like nonlinear dynamics. Let's go into this real quick, and let's at least start it. And that's synchrotron radiation, because I told you what a synchrotron is. And I should put quotes around this, because synchrotron radiation does not have to be just in synchrotrons. It's anywhere electrons bend in a B field, which includes synchrotrons. I mean, technically, it's anywhere that protons bend too, but protons are heavy, and we'll see some scaling laws maybe next class. So, but let's cover some of the important basics, and that is, let's see. So, accelerating charges radiate. You guys have learned about that, right? Have you covered in E&M yet something like the dipole distribution? So if I take a particle, a charged particle like an electron, and I move it back and forth, I shake it, what happens? Well, if I shake it, it's going to emit radiation. Is it going to emit radiation isotropically? No, because I'm shaking it in a certain direction. And particles like to emit radiation perpendicular to the direction that you're shaking them. So here, you know, if this is, you know, velocity, you know, I'm taking this thing and I'm shaking it up and down. What happens? Well, this thing ends up radiating in two lobes. And this thing is kind of cylindrically symmetric, right? Have you guys seen this at all? It's called dipole radiation. Uh-oh, I'm getting a bunch of blank looks. Uh-oh, I'm off the grid. Okay, so this is called dipole radiation. You will see it maybe later on in E&M. I should certainly hope, because it is. If not in this course, at the very least, you will see it in graduate level E&M. But in any event, this is how antennas work. Ever see a radio tower? Why is a radio tower vertical? It's not broadcasting up to the sky. That's because it's moving all of the electrons up and down and radiating horizontally like a dipole. Okay? And dipole, you know, this is kind of, you know, two lobes spherically symmetric around the thing. So in any event, I've got this charged particle and I've got this dipole radiation, and this dipole radiation kind of looks like, you know, there's a If this thing goes like theta, by gosh, you know, it kind of looks like theta goes from, you know, it kind of goes like the cosine of 2 theta, right? It's got a max out. Is that right? 180 degrees. It's certainly zero there, it's zero here, and it's zero at 180 degrees. And no, it's like the sine. It's got to be like the sine if I'm defining my theta that way. It's got some angular distribution. Let me just scratch that out. Ignore that, viewers at home. So in any event, it certainly has this form. So if I take a particle, and now I'm taking it and I've got this big magnet, and my poor electron is coming in. My poor electron is getting bent around and going through this magnet. Which way is the acceleration? Okay, well, the acceleration is this way. Right? So the electron is being accelerated. and it's being accelerated radially. That means that at some point, you know, when it's being accelerated radially in here, if I take that and I blow it up, I got my poor little electron and he's being accelerated this way. That means that he wants to, you know, make some synchrotron radiation kind of forwards and backwards, right? And this direction is his velocity. Okay. However, he's also very relativistic. This picture is kind of the classical picture, meaning non-relativistic. If I take this and I boost it now, what happens is I boost it in a way that there's my electron again. My acceleration is, you know, is still down there in the lab frame. My velocity is still over here in the lab frame. What happens, you know, you can think of this as the electron frame, and this is the lab frame. Oh, there you go. And what does the picture really look like? Well, because everything is boosted, this tail stuff gets really small, and the forward stuff gets really big and compressed, and that all of this radiation is what is called synchrotron radiation. I give a nice big relativistic boost from, and my electron tends to emit photons in the forward direction and emit a fair amount of radiation, and that radiation is nicely relativistically boosted, so it actually can be rather high energy. We can use it for imaging other things, like synchrotron light sources do. But that synchrotron radiation will also, you know, have unfortunate effects, because the electron is emitting radiation. It's losing energy, right? Because that radiation is not just purely in one direction. It actually is in a cone, and that cone has an opening angle that's about 1 over gamma or something like that. It also can change the particles, not just longitudinal momentum, but transverse momentums as well. So we'll go into next class exactly some of the math behind synchrotron radiation, behind this transform, so you can see how it actually scales with the particle energies. And then we'll talk a little bit about how synchrotron light sources work, and then the class after that, I'll actually perform a grand synthesis, which is, okay, you've got this concept of longitudinal dynamics, you've got this concept of synchrotron radiation, you've got this idea of trying to make this light bright. How can you do all of that? I will talk a little bit about the arrangements of magnets and the magnetic optics that you've learned in the context of modern synchrotron light sources, because there are multiple generations. You guys actually, when you did the double bend achromat for your homework, and turn in your homework if you got it, that was one of the great breakthroughs in designing something for synchrotron light sources up at Brookhaven back in the early 80s. So only 35 years ago. So we'll cover some of that, and that'll kind of connect a lot of pieces together before we end class. So I will post these, and we will go from there. Hand in your homework if you got it.